Hello, listeners. Since recording this episode, some of the statistics we used are out of date. For example, in just the past 24 hours, another 700 people have been killed in Gaza. This brings the death toll from the past 18 days to about 5,800 people, including more than 2,000 children. These numbers increase every hour. So please keep this in mind as you listen to the episode. Thank you.
We bring you this emergency Crawdads and Taters episode because there is a genocide happening in Palestine right now.
Last night, October 19th, Biden gave a national televised address calling for over $100 billion in emergency funds for Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, and further militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. We're going to play a few highlights for you now.
The terrorist group Hamas unleashed pure, unadulterated evil in the world. The United States remains committed to the Palestinian people's right to dignity and to self-determination. The actions of Hamas terrorists don't take that right away. Like so many other, I'm heartbroken by the tragic loss of Palestinian life, including the explosion at the hospital in Gaza, which was not done by the Israelis.
Total lie. Total and complete lie. We have undeniable evidence that Israel did this. It has been documented by several media outlets now.
Yeah, specifically Al Jazeera has debunked all of the lies of Israel, where they changed their story four different times. And I mean, you don't even need evidence.
You don't need evidence. If anybody with any knowledge about war whatsoever saw that video of this airstrike that came in at lightning speed and blew up the entire hospital, would know that Gaza would never have that kind of air power or military power.
They don't have airplanes.
They don't have airplanes.
They don't have long-range missiles
like that.
I mean, there's never been a Hamas rocket attack on Israel that has killed 500 people in one explosion.
Right.
It's just a total...
Total and complete total fabrication. And the fact that our president is willing to sit up there and lie to us like this should be... appalling. It should be appalling, but you know, we know that this is just part and parcel of U.S. empire propaganda.
It is, you know, just like when he said, you know, 40 beheaded babies.
Right.
You know, saw pictures. He claimed he saw pictures and they walked it back. They won't walk this one back, but it's the same lies.
Yeah.
Total propaganda.
Yep. Yeah. Biden met with Netanyahu the other day, in fact, and he was half asleep, but he said, about the hospital, the other team did it, right?
Yeah, the other team.
The other team. Yeah, it's despicable what's happening. I mean, he is just telling bald-faced lies to the U.S. public.
Okay, let's go to the next clip.
Okay.
Hamas and Putin represent different threats, but they share this in common. They both want to completely annihilate a neighboring democracy, completely annihilate it. Hamas' stated purpose for existing is the destruction of the state of Israel and the murder of Jewish people. Hamas does not represent the Palestinian people. Hamas uses Palestinian civilians as human shields, and innocent Palestinian families are suffering greatly because of them. Meanwhile, Putin denies Ukraine has or ever had real statehood. He claims the Soviet Union created Ukraine. And just 2 weeks ago, he told the world that if the United States and our allies withdraw, and if the United States withdraw, our allies will as well, military support for Ukraine would have, quote, a week left to live, but we're not withdrawing.
Neighboring democracies? I don't think Ukraine or Israel is really a democracy.
No. One's an apartheid state. One's a U.S. proxy state. Well, they're both U.S. proxy states.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Netanyahu has had massive protests against him. I think his, you know, rating is very low.
Yeah.
There's no kind of popular support for him. In fact, like 4 out of 5 Israelis blame the Hamas attack on Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he'd be in jail on corruption charges right now if he weren't waging this war.
Yeah, this is Biden. Hey, he's lying again.
Yeah, yeah. Neighboring democracies, whatever. Whatever.
Sensing a pattern with Biden's speech here. Let's go to the next clip.
Okay.
American leadership is what holds the world together. American alliances are what keep us, America, safe. American values are what make us a partner that other nations want to work with. To put all that at risk, if we walk away from Ukraine, if we turn our backs on Israel, it's just not worth it. That's why tomorrow I'm going to send to Congress an urgent budget request to fund America's national security needs, to support our critical partners, including Israel and Ukraine. It's a smart investment that's going to pay dividends for American security for generations. Help us keep American troops out of harm's way. Help us build a world that is safer, more peaceful, more prosperous for our children and grandchildren. In Israel, we must make sure that they have what they need to protect their people today and always. The security package I'm sending to Congress and asking Congress to do is an unprecedented commitment to Israel's security that will sharpen Israel's qualitative military edge, which we've committed to. The qualitative military edge. We're going to make sure Iron Dome continues to guard the skies over Israel. We're going to make sure other hostile actors in the region know that Israel is stronger than ever and prevent this conflict from spreading. Look, at the same time, President Netanyahu and I discussed again yesterday the critical need for Israel to operate by the laws of war. That means protecting civilians in combat as best as they can.
The laws of war. That's perhaps a complete rewriting of history. I mean, Israel's not obeying any laws of war. Everything they've been doing has been a war crime since the very beginning. For decades. But like every other military operation that Israel carries out, bombing hospitals, bombing churches, depriving people of water, shutting off electricity. These are war crimes.
Yeah, these are American values. That's what he was talking about. If war crimes are American values. I mean, the United States was founded on genocide, so we're just continuing a rich history of the great, wonderful United States. The world's going to look to us for leadership when it comes to genocidal regimes.
I just can't get over the lies. I just can't get over them.
Just as in World War II, today patriotic American workers are building the arsenal of democracy and serving the cause of freedom. America is a beacon to the world. Still. We are, as my friend Madeleine Albright said, the indispensable nation. Tonight there are innocent people all over the world who hope because of us, who believe in a better life because of us, who are desperate not to be forgotten by us, and are waiting for us. But time is of the essence. We cannot and will not let terrorists like Hamas and tyrants like Putin win. I refuse to let that happen. In moments like these, we have to remember who we are. We are the United States of America. The United States of America.
The United States of America.
So this is the part of Biden's speech dedicated to American exceptionalism, the indispensable nation.
The arsenal of democracy, which I think we're actually the arsenal of fascism. We export weapons to what, most of the totalitarian governments of the world, if not all.
A beacon to the world. And then he quotes his friend Madeleine Albright, who, as we have talked about on this podcast before, was made famous in the human rights community when she said that she thought the Iraqi sanctions killing 500,000 children, that she thought it was a price that was worth it. So this is the woman that he's quoting, the Secretary of War, Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, in his beacon of democracy, arsenal of democracy speech.
Yes, and we can't let evil Hamas and Putin, which are the same thing according to him,
right,
win. You have to connect those. It's right. really important for the propaganda.
Yeah, it's very important to always say Hamas and Putin in the same sentence. And that way you can justify the billions and billions of dollars that we'll be sending to Ukraine and Israel in the same sentence.
And that's why he's packaging the Israel and the Ukraine aid with Taiwan weapons, as well as the Mexican border.
Aid to the U.S.-Mexican, to further militarize the U.S.-Mexican border, you know, and of course, this is something that every administration has weaponized for decades, but Trump got all the bad rap for doing it, but Biden, you know, continues to build the wall, continues to send arms to the U.S.-Mexico border.
That's what Build Back Better really meant, was build back the wall better.
Right. So anyway, that was Biden's speech, you know, just full of gems of hypocrisy and propaganda. And now we will bring you a more in-depth analysis of what's going on.
Today, our children are writing their names on their palms in order to be recognized once the bombs hit their homes. Our men are digging mass graves to bury the identified and the unidentified. Our women are cleaning the burns on their bodies with regular soap because hospitals run out of antiseptics. Our rescue teams are eating bread covered in blood to sustain themselves. Our paramedics are killed while saving lives. Our elders are thirsty, looking for water to drink under the rubble. Our families are denied the right to mourn.
That was a clip from Laureen Saiyaj, diplomat and legal advisor at the Mission of the State of Palestine to the UN, describing the conditions on the ground in Gaza right now.
We wanted to bring you this episode today because of the urgency of what's happening in Gaza. We recognize that there has been bloodshed in Israel and Palestine, none of which do we revel in. However, the most dire situation that has been going on for decades has turned into a genocide. And we want to respond by bringing you a little bit more information about what's happening on the ground in Gaza, because, of course, the corporate media does not cover this. As of today, October 20th, the day that we're recording this episode, the Palestinian Health Ministry reports 4,100 Gazans have been killed and 13,000 injured. Of course, this is a number that's going up drastically every day.
One child is being killed every 15 minutes, I believe. It's insane. Mm-hmm. As of yesterday, at least 1,524 children have been killed by these Israeli airstrikes, which is around 40% of all the deaths in Gaza.
40% of all the deaths in Gaza are children. That's almost half of the people dying in Gaza are children.
Yeah.
And these are just the numbers that we know from aerial bombardment. We don't actually have an accurate count on the total number of dead in Gaza from starvation, from dehydration, since they're completely out of water and have been for many days, and those buried under the rubble. We know that as of October 17th, it was estimated that 1,000 civilians were still trapped under the rubble of bombed out buildings. And, you know, we haven't heard any update on that in 3 days. So we know that there's like at least 1,000 civilians, but probably a lot more trapped under bombed out buildings.
Yeah, we do know that 80,000 homes have been destroyed. And, you know, this is in Gaza, which is a landmass that is only 25 miles long and 5 miles wide. So about the size of Detroit, Michigan. Before the bombing began, 2.2 million people lived there. And that was, you know, a couple weeks ago, there were 2.2 million people there.
Mm-hmm. And now the number of internally displaced is around 1 million. So basically half of that entire population has now been completely displaced. And many days ago, they turned off fuel, water, electricity, internet, and stopped allowing medications and food to come through the border into Gaza. So Gaza residents have been drinking contaminated sewage water to survive.
And Israel has targeted water wells. 6 water wells have been bombed, along with 3 water pumping stations, 1 water reservoir, and one desalinization plant serving over 1.1 million people. So that's half of the people in Gaza were served by this desalination plant that was damaged by the bombing of Israel.
And it's worth noting that Israel regularly bombs infrastructure in Gaza, regularly bombs water plants and electrical stations. This is part and parcel of occupation, of settler colonialism, of mowing the lawn, as they call it. They just, from time to time, decide to bomb infrastructure. But this, I mean, obviously, when your houses are gone and everything is falling down on top of you, to bomb water stations right now, that would be a war crime.
Yeah, and when Russia targeted infrastructure in the Ukraine, the UN called for Putin to be tried for war crimes. Mm. And we have not heard a single peep from them about Netanyahu being charged for targeting critical infrastructure in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. In fact, in the first 6 days of bombing, Netanyahu bragged that 6,000 bombs had been dropped in 6 days on this tiny 25-mile section of Palestine. And this statistic comes from Israel itself because they were bragging about it. And we haven't heard an updated statistic on that, but if they are maintaining that same bombing rate, 1,000 bombs per day, then we'd be at 14,000 bombs now on day 14.
And so that is more bombs than the United States dropped on Afghanistan in a single year, just to keep that in perspective. Also, note that the 1,500 children that were killed, there's only been 500-some children killed in the Ukraine war over the past year and a half.
And we're on day 14 of this bombardment of Gaza.
So the one side that has been bombing children, Israel, has killed more children than two sides, Ukraine and Russia, combined have killed in Ukraine in 18 months.
Oh my God.
In a period of 14 days, two weeks.
And we know that Israel, in spite of Biden's tremendous lies, we know that Israel has been bombing hospitals regularly, schools, and UN refugee sites where children and women are hiding, thinking they are safe from being bombed. In fact, the World Health Organization has documented 59 bombings of healthcare facilities. The attacks have affected 26 healthcare facilities, including 17 hospitals and 23 ambulances. Four of the hospitals, all in northern Gaza, had to be evacuated and are no longer operational.
The hospital bombing that Biden said Israel did not do is just a pattern of multiple hospitals that have been targeted. They, in fact, hit that same hospital a couple days before the big explosion that Israel definitely did do, because there's a pattern of targeting hospitals.
Right.
And in addition to the hospitals, 178 educational facilities have been hit, including at least 20 UN schools, two of which were used as emergency shelters for displaced persons, and 140 Palestinian Authority schools, one of which was completely destroyed. One university building and seven churches were damaged, and at least 11 mosques were destroyed.
Okay, we've talked about this, but just to be more specific, on October 18th, Israel bombed the Al-Ali Hospital in Gaza, killing around 800 people, many of them women and children. This hospital was being used as a refugee center since so many people have lost their homes. There were patients just everywhere with all kinds of transmissible diseases. There were refugees just lining the hallways, people sleeping in the hallways. This was the hospital that was bombed by Israel on October 18th.
And then on October 19th, the next day, a historic church, which was sheltering hundreds of displaced Palestinians, was struck by another Israeli airstrike, killing dozens of people.
Also, Israel's constantly giving orders to different parts of Gaza that they need to evacuate. But then as soon as they flee, as soon as they get into a vehicle and start to flee, or most of them don't have vehicles, most of them are just walking. But as they are fleeing, they are being bombed. So again, UN refugee centers are being bombed, fleeing vehicles are being bombed. I mean, I can't even think of what could be more of a terror attack than telling people that they are safe in this place and then bombing them.
Right. This is another war crime. Telling them to flee to a hospital and then bombing the hospital, or these corridors that they're supposed to be safe on, that they're then bombing the caravans that they claim this is a safe area for refugees, and then they target the refugees. This is deliberate genocide.
And of course, Israel's not alone in this. We have the United States completely backing him up, as we have just heard from Biden. You also have British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak arriving in Tel Aviv, was it yesterday, Thursday, where he was greeted by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Sunak said he believed Israel's military was, quote, taking every precaution to avoid harming civilians.
That is absolutely ridiculous, considering that of the 4,000 people, over 4,000 people that have been killed, almost all of them, maybe all of them, are civilians. There's no evidence that they're targeting Hamas.
No.
This
is a pure war on civilians, pure collective punishment. And these are perpetrators of war crimes advertising. They're committing genocide, and they're just lying through their teeth about what they're doing. It's like Orwellian. They're just saying, oh, we're not going to target civilians. That's exactly what they're doing, is targeting civilians.
Okay, so the good news is there is some pushback on this, and it's coming from the Jewish community in the United States.
Well, it's and Palestinians,
and
of course.
Obviously Palestinians. There have been massive protests in the United States that have, the latest ones were led by If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace, two large Jewish organizations which are anti-Zionist and are calling for a ceasefire. Yesterday, October 19th, more than 500 Jewish activists were arrested at the U.S. Capitol during one of these protests. I want to play a clip here from one of them.
Right. But before we play that clip really quick, I just want to say, this is huge that we are seeing this number of Jewish activists that are speaking up and getting arrested. It feels like there is a sea change or a shift in the public consciousness happening. So this is definitely good news. But here's that clip from Jewish Voice for Peace. These are the words of Talia Bauer, who was one of 57 people arrested at a solidarity demonstration for the people of occupied Gaza in New York City.
My grandfather survived Auschwitz, and that is why I fight for a free Palestine. I have always felt deeply connected to his memory and to his love. His story has inspired me always to seek justice. And so last night, as Shabbat came in, I took my Jewish star necklace, which belonged to my Saba, my grandfather, and I clasped it around my neck. And then I clasped my arms with over 100 other New Yorkers to block traffic so that the world would hear us say, as Jews, we unequivocally call for an end to the genocide happening at this very moment in Gaza. As we were being taken to jail, those around me were sharing stories of their grandparents, and we were all deeply feeling our ancestors with us last night as we took a stand against genocide, because we know what it looks like. While we were at Chuck Schumer's house calling for a ceasefire, he was inside preparing for a trip to Israel to pledge more weapons and more money for ethnic cleansing in Gaza. We are only going to build from here. We are going to escalate to bring an end to U.S. complicity and moral cover for this violence. We will never stop fighting against genocide, and we will not stop fighting until Palestine is free.
Oh my God, that's so beautiful. I'm totally crying right now. I just wanted to say that, I just respect so much the Jewish people that are speaking up right now, because, so many of us who have worked on Palestine issues for decades are being called anti-Semitic for speaking up. And when it comes from Jewish people themselves, this level of resistance and this level of truth, talking about what happened to their own ancestors in the Holocaust and why that motivates them to make sure that it never happens again. That to me is the most beautiful and convincing argument that anybody could ever make on Palestine. And the fact that people like Netanyahu and the warmongers that are trying to twist our sympathies for Palestine and turn it into some kind of anti-Semitism is just the most disgusting and inhumane type of propaganda that I have ever known. So I just wanted to say that and encourage everybody who wants to speak out for Palestine to speak out for Palestine. You are not anti-Semitic. You are standing with thousands of Jews around the world who are standing up against this.
Yeah, we need everybody to speak out on behalf of Palestine right now against this genocide. I'm really glad that these organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace exist and are out there fighting every day for the Palestinian people.
Yeah. So, just to get back to what's actually happening on the ground, for those, if there's anybody who doesn't know what happened in the last 2 weeks, we just want to bring you a short little update on what led us to this point.
On October 7th, there were around 1,400 people killed in Israel in a surprise attack by Hamas and other Palestinian resistance groups. 203 hostages were taken by these fighters and taken back into Gaza. Of the 1,400 people who were killed, Israel has released information on 700, which includes 317 civilians, 285 soldiers, 57 police officers, and 20 children. That's kind of goes against Israel's own narrative, where they have portrayed all 1,400 of these people who were killed as being innocent civilians. U.S. and Israeli officials continue to spread lies about rape and beheaded and burnt babies, in spite of these claims being completely unsubstantiated. The White House had to walk back Biden's comments about the beheaded babies. The L.A. Times had to retract their story about rape. If we listened to Biden, we'd think that all of these Israelis were simply women and children. But the reality, according to Israel's own statistics, is that a large amount of them were actually combatants, soldiers and police officers, people who had been directly involved in the repression of the Palestinian people. And it's also worth noting that most Israeli civilians are also trained, because Israel has universal military service with only a few exceptions to the rule. And Israel has also been arming settlers in Gaza and the West Bank. So it's very hard to distinguish that, you know, any Israeli, other than obviously children, can be considered truly a non-combatant or a civilian.
Right. And that's, I think, a super important point, and something that I didn't even fully realize until a couple of weeks ago, that because there is mandatory enlistment for everybody over 18, regardless of sex, gender, whatever, that everyone over 18 living in Israel is a soldier. That's huge. And then what you said about arming settlers, so much of the violence has been these military settler vigilante groups that have been given free rein by the government to just go in and start massacring Palestinian civilians. And fortunately, we see that we've seen this pattern throughout history under brutal settler colonialism, and it is no different here.
And the Israeli government has been justifying the last 2 weeks of genocide, the bombing, everything we just described, which is collective punishment on all the people of Gaza. They're justifying this based on it being a response to the attacks by Hamas, the killing of these 1,400 Israelis. And here's a clip from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, where he describes this.
This is a part of an axis of evil. Of Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas. Their goal, open goal, is to eradicate the state of Israel. The open goal of Hamas is to kill as many Jews as they could, and the only difference is they would have killed every last one of us, murdered every last one of us, if they could. They just don't have the capacity, but they murdered an extraordinary 1,300 civilians, which in American terms is like many, many, many 9/11s.
That was Netanyahu. Sounded a lot like Biden's speech. Netanyahu said that before Biden did, but it's a common theme talking about 9/11, axis of evil, and also targeting Iran.
Yeah, they're actually repeating the same talking points, this whole axis of evil shit that they did right after 9/11. And that is very intentional. There are no accidents here with this level of propaganda. We have to know that just like after 9/11, they wanted to justify a massive attack against, you know, large parts of Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And so this is their way of setting up whatever level of violence they want to achieve after this event. that they claim was the beginning of history. They think that time started with these Hamas attacks on October 7th, but clearly we all know better. But what I find interesting, Taters, that I wanted to bring up is that there were some critical lessons we learned from 9/11, which is that, for example, even though 19 of the 26 hijackers were Saudi Arabians, the United States turned around and waged war on Afghanistan and Iraq for the next 20 years. And they had nothing to do with 9/11, but they had their own geopolitical interests in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so they used 9/11, as Naomi Klein would say, as a sort of shock doctrine to then turn around and implement whatever form of disaster capitalism they wanted after that, which in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan was all about oil. And spoiler alert, there's going to be some major infrastructure projects that follow this as well. We know that. We know this is how this works.
And I mean, using 9/11 as an example is awful because the United States' response to 9/11 was a complete disaster.
Complete disaster.
They're trying to justify Israel's revenge bombing of the Gaza Strip as being a response to a terrorist attack, when the U.S. did the same thing with, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. This was George Bush trying to get back for them trying to kill his daddy. And we killed over 1 million people in Iraq. We spent 20 years in Afghanistan to replace the Taliban with the Taliban. It's complete disaster, humanitarian disaster, millions killed.
And the repression of Muslims in the United States that followed, the hatred, the terrorism, the domestic terrorism towards the Muslim population in the United States was unmatched after 9/11. And I'm sure we can expect something very similar towards Arab Americans now after this.
We've already seen one five-year-old child murdered, six-year-old child murdered brutally.
By his landlord.
By his landlord, just because he was a Muslim.
Yeah. So, you know, this is just one example of, I'm sure, what will be many, many examples of hate and domestic terrorism against Muslim Americans.
Yeah. And so I think it's important to note that this did not start on October 7th. We actually had reports of Israeli snipers shooting Palestinians in the lower extremities. High number increase in that over the last few weeks before October 7th. So anyone who says this was unprovoked is incorrect. Israel has been bombing and occupying Palestine for 75 years, and they've never needed any justification to launch violence against Palestinians.
They've been bombing, displacing, and violently occupying Palestine as an apartheid state decades before Hamas even existed. This is just the nature of apartheid occupation and genocide. But before we get into any more analysis of this genocide, we want to be transparent about our lens and our framing so that you can understand why we are using these terms and how we are analyzing these global atrocities. And yes, on October 15, 2023, over 800 scholars and practitioners of international law, conflict studies, and genocide studies signed a public statement warning of the possibility of genocide being perpetrated by Israeli forces against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Here is Ross Siegel, Israeli historian with a Master's of Arts in Holocaust and Genocide Studies, speaking on Democracy Now!
I think that indeed what we're seeing now in Gaza is a case of genocide. We have to understand that the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide from 1948 requires that we see special intent for genocide to happen. And to quote the convention, intent to destroy a group as defined as racial, ethnic, religious, or national, as such, that is collectively, not just individuals. And this intent, as we just heard, is on full display by Israeli politicians and army officers. Since 7th of October, we heard Israel's president. It's well known what Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said on 9th of October, declaring a complete siege on Gaza, cutting off water, food, fuel, stating that we're fighting human animals and we will react accordingly. He also said that we will eliminate everything We know that Israeli army spokesperson Daniel Hagari, for example, acknowledged one-tune destruction and said explicitly the emphasis is on damage and not on accuracy. So we're seeing this special intent on full display. And really, I have to say, if this is not special intent to commit genocide, I really don't know what is. So when we look at the actions taken, the dropping of thousands and thousands of bombs in a couple of days, including phosphorus bombs, as we heard, on one of the most densely populated areas around the world, together with these proclamations of intent, this indeed constitutes genocidal killing, which is the first act, according to the convention, of genocide. And Israel, I must say, is also perpetrating act number 2 and 3 that is causing serious bodily or mental harm and creating condition designed to bring about the destruction of the group by cutting off water, food, supply of energy, bombing hospitals, ordering the fast evictions of hospitals, which the World Health Organization has declared to be, quote, a death sentence. So we're seeing the combination of genocidal acts with special intent. This is indeed a textbook case of genocide.
Yeah, so I think Russ Siegel pretty much says it all. This is a textbook definition of genocide, what's happening now. And I really appreciate him pointing out the part that we hadn't emphasized yet about the Israeli defense minister calling Palestinians human animals, because we know that one of the first steps in genocide is to dehumanize your victims. That's what they do. Also, just wanted to say it's worth noting that in this tiny little densely populated, one of the most densely populated areas in the world of Gaza, 70% of these people were already ethnically cleansed by Israel in 1948 in the Nakba. They were displaced from parts of 520 communities that Israeli troops erased back to the earth. In 1948, they committed 50 massacres and pushed Palestinians out of Palestine in 1948 in droves. And Israel has now openly stated that it wants to repeat the same ethnic cleansing again.
Yeah, that's the Nakba was a terrible period in Palestinian history. I think it translates roughly to what the disaster
mm-hmm. or catastrophe.
Catastrophe. Yeah. And just horrible. 750,000 Palestinians were displaced by Israel. I think it's important that we talk about the history of this region a little bit. Because, you know, it's very contentious. Both Palestinians and Israelis claim this land as their homeland. So I'm going to quote from a book by Norman Finkelstein, the son of Holocaust survivors, a renowned author, activist, a professor, who has spent 50 years studying the Israeli-Palestine conflict. He is likely the foremost authority on the subject. And he wrote this in his 2019 book, Gaza, an inquest into its martyrdom. Quote, on 29th of November 1947, the UN General Assembly approved a resolution partitioning British-mandated Palestine into a Jewish state incorporating 56% of Palestine and an Arab state incorporating the remaining 44%. In the war that ensued after the passage of the resolution, the newly born state of Israel expanded its borders to incorporate nearly 80% of Palestine. The only areas of Palestine not conquered comprised the West Bank, which the Kingdom of Jordan subsequently annexed, and the Gaza Strip, which came under Egypt's administrative control.
Wow. Yeah. So that was like all of Palestine was annexed in the years after 1947, except those two areas, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Right now we're seeing bombing in both areas. We're seeing a bombardment in both areas.
Yes, and I think it's noteworthy that the West Bank is not controlled by Hamas, but Israel is still murdering people in the West Bank. So this is not a war on Hamas. This is a war on Palestine.
That's right. And like we said earlier, you know, Israel has been conducting this war on Palestine for decades, long before Hamas even existed. And so the fact that they're using Hamas as the reason is a convenient excuse at this point, but they've been doing the same thing for 75 years to the people of Palestine. So just think about that a little bit. I want to address the Jewish claim that Palestine, that this area is, that they call Israel, has been their homeland for thousands of years, because I'm sure as many of you know that Zionists trace their land claim back all the way to the biblical descendants of Abraham and say that this was their entitled and granted homeland for the sons of Abraham. The problem with this claim is that it's always been based on the denial that these are the ancestral homelands of Palestinian Arabs. And this religious claim has always come with this kind of entitlement to this land that is based on exclusion and expulsion of the people who are already there. I mean, you can say that an area is yours and then also be inclusive of the people who are already there, but that's not what happened. The religious entitlement has always come with this sort of genocidal notion that they needed to suppress, repress, and exile the people who are already there. What Israel is today, by every human rights observer who's been there in the last several decades, has been called an apartheid state, an open-air prison, and a concentration camp. By UN officials, by human rights witnesses, pretty much anybody who goes over there sees that it's entrapped on four sides by giant walls all the way around. People can't get in or out. You can't get food in or out. Infrastructure is routinely bombed. I mean, people are in a prison. So whatever your religious claim to the land, you can't justify genociding the people who were living there first. I mean, we know all about this in the United States. There's no justification for this. It violates all international laws. In fact, the United Nations has condemned Israel some 140 times for its illegal occupation and expansion, its displacement and violent repression of the Palestinian people who have been living there for thousands of years.
As in previous cases, the Western media and political establishment justifies the prevailing support for attacking Gaza by asserting that Israel has the right to defend itself and has no other option against Palestinian militants who refuse to accept its existence. And so, kind of to clarify this right to defend itself, I want to play a clip here from Norman Finkelstein.
You all use the rhetorical question, doesn't Israel have the right to self-defense? I ask you this question. Do concentration camp guards have the right to self-defense? That to me is a very perplexing question, because the answer is just perfectly obvious. Do concentration camp guards have the right to self-defense? If you read the new Human Rights Watch report, it says that Israel is committing, as we speak, it's committing crimes against humanity in Gaza.
Yeah, so I think the answer to that question is simply that concentration camp guards do not have a right to self-defense.
And now I'm going to quote Aaron Monte, independent journalist and son of Gabor Monte, who we will discuss more in just a second. Aaron Monte says, as a legal matter, the former assertion is false. Well, while Israel has an internationally recognized right to defend itself from attack, it does not have the right to commit war crimes against a besieged civilian population. Moreover, Israel is not, quote, defending itself, end quote, against an external aggressor, but an imprisoned internal population that also has a recognized right to resist military occupation, but not, as is evident, to kill and kidnap Israeli civilians. To adopt the Israeli-U.S. narrative, therefore, requires, quote, ignoring Israel's structural violence and cruelty, as Amira Haas writes, quote, and the context of the Palestinian people's ongoing dispossession from their land, end quote.
Aaron Mate is an established journalist with The Gray Zone. We've quoted him many times on our podcast. And just, this was from his Substack, so you know, go check out his Substack and check out the work that he's done.
Yeah, he's very articulate on this, and there's a lot we could say about the right of prisoners to defend themselves, the right of occupied, repressed people who have been brutally colonized for decades to defend themselves and to spin the narrative so that it's always and only Israel that has a right to defend itself is absolutely ridiculous and absurd in this situation where the Palestinian people are being so severely repressed. Now we're going to hear a quote from Gabor Mate, who is Aaron's father, coincidentally, and a Holocaust survivor himself. So obviously Gabor and Aaron are both Jewish. Gabor Mate is a renowned author, speaker, and therapist, expert on trauma, addiction, stress, and childhood development. Really renowned human rights speaker around the world.
In my teenage years in Canada, I became a Zionist. This dream of the Jewish people resurrected in their historical homeland and the barbed wire of Auschwitz being replaced by the boundaries of a Jewish state with a powerful army. I found it liberating. It was exhilarating to believe in that dream. And I absorbed all that perspective and all that point of view, and I really believed in it. And then I found out that it wasn't exactly like that. That in order to make this Jewish dream a reality, we had to visit a nightmare on the local population. You couldn't, there was a Zionist slogan called a land without a people for a people without a land. But there was no people with, there was no land without a people. There was people living there who'd been living there for hundreds and years or even longer. As a matter of fact, if you want to hear something really interesting, and David Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister of Israel, actually subscribed to this. He said this, who are the Palestinians? Because the Jews in Roman times, all of them never left Palestine. Many of them stayed there. And some of them, hundreds of years later, converted to Islam. So guess who the Palestinians are? In some ways, they might be descendants of ancient Jews. They are cousins, to say the least, no matter how you look at it. And you know, and there's no way you could have ever created a Jewish state without oppressing and expelling the local population, which is what they did in 1947, beginning in 1947, and first of all with British Empire protection, you know, but they did this. And then in 1948, Jewish Israeli historians have shown without a doubt that the expulsion of the Palestinians was persistent. It was pervasive, it was cruel, it was murderous, and with deliberate attempt.
Yeah, I so respect the voice of Dr. Gabor Mate. He comes from, he was a Holocaust survivor himself, and he comes from this history of severe, deep trauma and repression, and has spent his entire life understanding trauma and teaching about trauma and helping other people with trauma. So he, to me, is one of the most authentic and clear-headed and humanitarian voices on this topic. And he understands exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, I think it's important to see how, you know, he himself was a Zionist for a while there, like you said. And then he found out that Zionism was based on this lie that Israel was a land without a people, but the Palestinians were there. And when Israel was created with the mandate of the UN and with the backing of the United States and Britain, the two victors coming out of World War II, two extreme superpowers at the time, they expelled these Palestinian people. So, you know, this was not a conflict between two nation states, but rather colonizer against the colonized. And this means that the power dynamics are completely different than in, you know, a war between two countries. So in 1938, Mahatma Gandhi, I think everyone knows who he is, you know, famous Indian resistance, the proponent of nonviolence, who was, you know, influential in India getting its independence from the British Empire. He wrote on the same subject, quote, "It is wrong and inhumane to impose the Jews on the Arabs. What is going on in Palestine today cannot be justified by any moral code of conduct. The mandates have no sanction but that of the last war. Surely it would be a crime against humanity to reduce the proud Arabs so that Palestine can be restored to the Jews partly or wholly as their national home.
So that was 10 years before Israel became a state.
Yes, yes.
And it was already, this repression was already clearly happening.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the Balfour Declaration in 1917. And even before that, Zionists were making claims to the land in the 1880s. But really, the British Empire was trying to make Israel happen, you know, even 10 years before, like you say, in 1938. Mm-hmm. And Gandhi, who was a proponent of nonviolence, even he admits that, quote, "But according to the accepted canons of right and wrong, nothing can be said against the Arab resistance in the face of overwhelming odds." Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's arguing for the right of the Arabs to resist the colonization of their homelands, of Palestine.
Right. As other nonviolent experts throughout history have spoken about.
Yes, exactly. I also want to quote here from a Paulo Freire, from a Pedagogy of the Oppressed, another, you know, famous author, scholar, where he wrote here saying, quote, "Never in history has violence been initiated by the oppressed. How could they be the initiators if they themselves are the result of violence? How could they be the sponsors of something whose objective inauguration called forth their existence as oppressed? There would be no oppressed had there been no prior situation of violence to establish their subjugation."
That's such a great quote, because so much of the propaganda, just like with Ukraine's unprovoked invasion, has been that this was an unprovoked aggression by Hamas on October 7th. And nothing could be further from the truth when we talk about the history of violent settler colonialism that has been taking place in this region for decades and decades. It's just totally absurd. And so, yeah, we have to look to Gandhi, look to Paulo Freire, and look to other people who understand what settler colonialism is and the kind of structural violence that Palestinians have been under for decades and decades in order to understand what resistance looks like in a situation like this.
Like Paulo says, you know, that violence is not initiated by the oppressed. It's the oppressor who always initiates the violence because they're imposing their will on these people. You know, another quote would be from Frantz Fanon, the Marxist philosopher, humanist, psychologist. He said, quote, "We revolt simply because, for many reasons, we can no longer breathe." That's just a simple, beautiful quote by Fanon. The simple fact that the oppressed, there's a point where when they can no longer breathe, they have no other option but right. to revolt.
You have no rights. You have no means of survival. Your back is up against a wall. That is the situation in Palestine. I want to quote from Aaron Monte again from his most recent Substack. He gives a really interesting historical example about Israel, quote, defending itself. And I just thought this was so revealing. And it kind of gives you a window into how Israeli-U.S. propaganda about the settler colony of Israel has changed over the years. Here's what Aaron Monte writes. "That Israel is defending itself from a people that it has colonized has long been acknowledged at the highest levels. At a 1956 funeral for an Israeli soldier killed by Palestinians in Gaza, General Moshe Dayan, one of Israel's most famed military leaders, advised the following, quote, "Let us not cast blame on the murderers today. Why should we deplore their burning hatred for us? For 8 years, they have been sitting in refugee camps in Gaza. And before their eyes, we have been transforming the lands and villages where they and their fathers dwelt into our estate," end quote. Dayan, having led Israeli forces in the military campaign during Israel's founding in 1948, recognized that his country originated with the dispossession of Palestinians and theft of their homelands. Yet his acknowledgement was not an act of remorse. rather than attempt to reverse or redress the forced expulsion of Palestinians, Dayan went on to decree that Israel should maintain the colonization with even more aggression. Quote, "We are a generation that settles the land, and without the steel helmet and the cannon's maw, we will not be able to plant a tree and build a home. Let us not fear to look squarely at the hatred that consumes and fills the lives of hundreds of Arabs who live around us. Let us not drop our gaze, lest our arms weaken. This is the fate of our generation. That is our choice, to be ready and armed, tough and hard, or else the sword shall fall from our hands and our lives will be cut short." So that was in 1956. And in the nearly 70 years since Dayan spoke those words, Israel has heeded them by expanding its theft of Palestinian land and creating new generations of refugees. As B'Tselem, the leading Israeli human rights groups, acknowledged in 2021, this has turned Israel into, quote, "an apartheid regime that promotes and perpetuates Jewish supremacy between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River," end quote. And that's all from Aaron Mate.
Yeah, and if you you look at a picture of this Dayan guy, he's got this eye patch on. He looks like a villain from like a B-class war movie. It reminds me of Biden's pure, unadulterated evil quote about Hamas. I feel like that describes this General Moshe Dayan, just like listening to the words he says, where he is promoting the genocide of Palestinians back in 1956.
So speaking of apartheid states, we just wanted to kind of define what an apartheid state is and describe what that looks like in Gaza.
Talked about this a little bit before. Gaza has been described as the world's largest open-air prison. There are militarized borders on all sides other than where the sea is, and Israel patrols the sea as well so that there's no escape from Gaza. All movement in and out and within Gaza is controlled by Israel.
Military checkpoints all throughout Gaza. Israel also controls all access to food, water, hospitals, internet, electricity, and routinely cuts these off just randomly and at will. And they also cut off medical supplies at will.
Yeah, and that's what's going on right now with this. There's no water, there's no food, electricity, as we talked about earlier.
And there hasn't been for days and days.
And they regularly bomb both infrastructure and civilians in Gaza, and they call this mowing the lawn, which is just a disgusting...
Disgusting genocidal term.
So for the last 15 years, Gaza has been under this blockade where Israel controls everything. And the effect of this blockade is, it's just been terrible. It's been devastating. The World Bank estimated in 2015 that the GDP losses caused by the blockade since 2007 was above 50% and entailed large welfare losses. Gaza's manufacturing sector, once significant, shrunk by as much as 60% in real terms due to the wars in the past 20 years and the blockade. And Gaza's exports have virtually disappeared since the imposition of the blockade. Essentially, their economy has been shut down. Unemployment skyrocketed. People can just, they barely can survive.
Yep. And as we talked about before, in addition to this situation, Israel regularly for decades has committed war crimes and finds any excuse to murder Palestinians at will, just use them as target practice, to kill them at checkpoints, to kill them while they're doing peaceful protests, to kill children while they're throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers. While they're not throwing rocks, just any time. Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time. And throughout my life, I can remember military operations every few years that murder hundreds to thousands of Palestinians.
Yeah, and the death rate for Palestinians to Israelis has been, for many years, been calculated around 23 to 1. That means for every Israeli death, there's 23 Palestinian deaths. So, I mean, that is just absurd. that number. You know, that's not a war. That's a genocide. That's all that is. And we're seeing that today with the continued bombing of Palestine, where we're up to over 4,000 Palestinians are dead now.
Right. And we know that that 23-to-1 ratio is likely going to, you know, greatly increase at this point. That's probably not even relevant anymore. I just wanted to mention a couple of the operations, the Israeli military operations that I remember personally that really affected me. In 2008, Operation Cast Lead, that was, I don't even remember what they claimed was the provocation for that. They had some excuse, but they launched this operation where they led a 22-day military assault on Gaza, and the ferocity of the attack was unprecedented in more than the 6-decade-old conflict at that point. And it killed some 1,400 Palestinians, you know, mainly civilians, and there were bombed hospitals and all of that. And in the aftermath of that bombardment, a UN-appointed fact-finding mission found strong evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Investigations by groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch came to the same conclusion. And then the other, you know, operation that I remember, which was very recent, was the Great March of Return that started in 2018, where Palestinians were participating in a peaceful march and Israeli forces opened fire on the crowd. And this violence coincided with the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. Palestinians were protesting, but they did it nonviolently. And in that operation, 214 Palestinians, including 46 children, were killed. Over 36,100 were wounded, including 8,800 children. And I just, you know, journalists were shot. IDF soldiers were shooting people in the knees for fun, like from the fence, from the border wall. And it was like, okay, so this is what happens when Palestinians resist nonviolently. This is the Israeli reaction.
Yeah, I read the Human Rights Watch report on this, and it goes over details about, you know, how they specifically targeted medics. They targeted a man in a wheelchair, a double amputee in a wheelchair. They targeted children, and these were specifically targeted short range by Israeli snipers. They could definitely identify who they were. They could clearly see they were journalists, they were medics, they were children, they were old men, they were disabled.
Yeah, they were wearing giant press vests, brightly colored vests to identify them as media.
And this is what happened when Palestine tried nonviolence. So for anyone who's saying, well, I wish, you know, they would resist nonviolently, that's not an option for them, really. It's something that maybe we can resist nonviolently in the United States today, although we're increasingly losing that here as well. But this is definitely not something that the oppressed people of Palestine are able to do, because Israel responds to nonviolence with violence.
Yep. It's always violence. It's always been violence. It's been a violent oppression before Hamas. It's been a violent oppression when Palestinians resist nonviolently. It is just an apartheid, violent military oppression.
Due to the emergency nature of this episode, we have decided to cut it into two parts to get the first part out sooner. We will publish the rest of our discussion later this week. Thanks for listening to Crawdads and Taters. Please support our work at patreon.com/crawdadsandtaters. Thank you to William Huffman, Todd Munson, Old Left, Kenny Jones, Janae Saliba, Greta Hunicky, and our VIP rebels Ben Andrews and Liz Font. Thank you so much for supporting us. We couldn't do this without your support. Please subscribe and share our podcast with your friends. Pro-Palestinian posts are being suppressed by social media outlets, and we need this information to be spread as widely as possible. And stay tuned for the second part of our discussion, coming soon.